Coffee ready?
Yeah. Here you go.
Thanks. All right. Detroit and I will be firing the particle beam weapons. This is as much a test for the weapons' capabilities in a strike force situation, as well as cutting off the Red's supply of spare parts and ammunition. Everybody's rifles clear?
It seems so, yeah. No dirt clogging a barrel, no scratches or nothing. I tell you, the technicians designed these things better than Schechter could have.
Good. I don't need to tell you the importance of this strike. If these beams work well in a controlled combat situation, the destruction of the United Soviet States is almost a foregone conclusion. This will be the first time in 100 years, man, that we, as Americans, will truly be able to talk about winning.
Glad to be a part of it, Rock.
Well said, Lang. To be a part of history.
I can't wait to blow me up some Russians.
You always know just what to say.
The men checked their conventional weapons. McCoughlin and Lang unpacked a rapid-fire mortar, which they manned as a team. Archer loaded a band of 10 2-foot-long razor-sharp arrows onto the side of his crossbow, a device he'd constructed which allowed firing arrows one after another.
Sounds like... Yeah, the storm's heading out.
Really?
The men emerged from the confines of the synth nylon mountain tent and stepped outside into the muddy ground. The last of the coiling snake-like clouds were flying off to the west to wreak further damage. The storm would move all the way to the unknown lands of what had been California and on into the Pacific Ocean, where it would finally blow itself out several hundred miles out at sea. They watched the clouds roll quickly away to be replaced by rapidly brightening skies. The sun aggressively pushed herself back into prominence, burning away the gray, misty fog which pervaded the air. A long-arched double rainbow of pinks and violets and blood-red tones, common after the war due to atmospheric alterations.
I think they're coming.
Yeah?
Yeah. Listen. Concentrate.
Shit. There's a lot of them. I can see their exhaust trail from here. Better make some sort of camouflage, men. With the skies clearing, they'll be sending choppers ahead for recon.
The men broke down the tent and took off their own brown and gray patterned ponchos, laying them across large rocks at the edge of the plateau. They eased into position as comfortably as was possible in the still soggy dirt and aimed their weapons down onto the road where the convoy would soon pass. Rock lay flat on his stomach and sighted along the three triangular sights of the black beam weapon. The sights gave off a reddish glow, except in the very center of the triangle where the target was. When the target was dead center of the triangles, it would brighten considerably, signaling the holder of the rifle to fire. The particle beam weapon contained a memory as well, locking in the coordinates of the target once it had been found. Even if the person firing the weapon slipped or jerked as they pulled the trigger, the weapon itself would compensate as the particle beam shot out. The first of the Red convoy came into view at the far end of the valley. Typical Russian defensive array, swift-moving armored vehicles with machine guns, scouting, darting ahead, followed by 10 Soyuz 12 tanks, nearly 50 feet long, capable of hitting 40 miles per hour on a flat road. Then came the truck convoy itself, nearly 100 of the big tractor trailers stretched along the muddy road like one of the legendary freight trains of old that Roxon had read about. A rich target. He fingered the long, smooth weapon impatiently.
Good. They missed us.
He set the particle beam on highest energy output, a beam of about a 6-inch diameter. This, the technicians had instructed him, was the most powerful of the weapon settings. Detroit lay nearly 30 yards away, sighting on the second tank. Sweat oozed through the skin of his powerful neck. He moved his finger back and forth on the trigger guard, suddenly craving a cigarette, and knowing he couldn't move an inch now to get one.
Fire!
The black beam hung in the air, bridging the 3,247 feet between Roxon and the tank in a millionth of a second. The tank turned from dark gray to cherry red, and then a blinding white in the space of about 1 second. Then...
Detroit, take out the trench!
The 50-foot tank lurched sideways, sinking down into the mud as its opposing tread continued to spin frantically, driving the tank around in circles, deeper and deeper into the mud, until it lay half-buried, blocking the highway.
Move the Sawyer! Tank 3, 4, force it off the road! Fight the Tuckers and kill them!
Chen, meanwhile, slid off unnoticed down the side of the mountain toward the valley floor below. He moved like a cat among the rocks and scraggly brush of the slope, a star knife in each hand. If the Reds tried an assault on the peak from which the free fighters were firing, they would be in for a few surprises.
Form a defensive formation! Our rear guard's been destroyed! There is no escape for cowards! You know where they are! Fire, you foolish!
Thick titanium alloy melted away under the onslaught of the beams. Within minutes, nearly all the tanks and armored vehicles had been destroyed. McCoughlin and Lang continued to fire the mortar, sending out rounds every 20 seconds. Chen lay hidden in a grove of red-barked dwarf pines halfway up the mountainside from the Red Column. Beams, bullets, and shells from the Red tanks flew past him, looking for something to destroy. He peered around the edge of the grove and saw six Red soldiers with submachine guns coming up the slope to outflank the American attack force. With a star knife in each hand, Chen jumped from his hiding place. One of the five-pointed blades ripped into a Red chest, the other into the shoulder blade. Both exploded on contact.
Fire!
Man.
Where'd he go? Over there, to the right! He's just one man! Vignolino!
Where are you?
Here I am.
The man fell backwards, his windpipe crushed. His brain was already dead from the lack of oxygen. It would take his heart minutes to stop. But already, the would-be killer was motionless. Chen surveyed the slope down to the valley road, but saw no others. Back up on the ledge of the mountain, the free fighters didn't let up their fire for a moment. Roxon and Detroit fired down the single-file line of huge diesels. The Red troops' eyes grew wide in horror as the black beams made their way towards them. Most of them screamed in mortal terror in the few seconds before they were evaporated.
One truck left. Detroit?
Ready?
Aim? Fire!
The shower of glowing particles that had been the truck floated like little seeds of shrapnel back down to the blood-splattered, muddy ground. The free fighters looked slowly along the valley road at a scene of total destruction. A trail of melted, twisted, smoking wreckage fused into the very mud itself, into impossible shapes and configurations that death takes on when it dances among the armies of man. Nothing was left. just piles of bubbling metal and glowing rubble lighting the smoke above the road, as if lighting the way for the souls of the dead to leave this valley of death. At the far end of the roadway, just beyond the last of the destroyed trucks, two armored vehicles that had been taking up the rear tore off.
I got them.
No, let them go. Let them tell the others what happened here. I want the whole damn Russian army to understand that the ball game has changed. We'll strike at their morale just as we've struck at their supply route.
The roadway looked like the bowels of hell itself. Smoking metal and human corpses. Piles of grotesquely melted Russian bodies, their flesh running into one another. Bones sticking from out of red mud.
We've done it, men. Another weapon of incalculable destructive power has been unleashed. One day, there will be no more need to kill men. But today, America must be liberated from its oppressors. This wasn't a strike. This was a rout. A bloodbath. A massacre. A message. Let the Red leaders in Washington know what has happened here. And that we're coming for them. Soon.
The White House was festooned with large red silk flags. Across the front gate of the Capitol swung a banner with four profile pictures in gold of Lenin, Drubkin, who had conquered the world through nuclear war a century before, Premier Vasily, and President Zhabnov. It waved lightly in the cool November breeze, as if welcoming the visiting dignitaries from the global Soviets who walked below. The speeches had already begun, though delegates were still arriving at Chekhov Airport in monstrous Ilyushin 9 and Tupolev 180 long-range jets. They walked as unobtrusively as possible into the halls of Congress, into the Senate chambers, where rows of guests, mid- and upper-level bureaucrats from the Soviet provinces throughout the world, sat and listened to boring, plodding speeches about the greatness of the Russian Empire. The Soviet delegates approved of everything that was said with thunderous applause, knowing full well that any speeches given were already policy approved on high. Zhabnov would speak last. To walk in late on his words was treading on dangerous ground, but the preliminary speakers going on endlessly about improvements in transport and food production, here in the US and the like, were already into their second day of non-stop talking. The lower-level functionaries who had listened attentively to these dry messages daydreamed of their soon-to-be-fulfilled desires, a Washington, D.C. party. The delegates, who had attended the bashes in earlier years, came back with tales that were unrivaled anywhere in the world for their sumptuous debauchery. The delegates to the AD 2089 yearned to hear the end of the speeches and be off to the parties. Parties to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Red occupation of America. Although two huge banners with pictures of Colonel Kilov, the head of KGB in America, flanked the stage, there was not another KGB emblem or picture in all of the assembly halls and chambers, an unprecedented snub. KGB officers were in a distinct minority among the delegates. Something was going on, and Zhabnov's annual speech may shed light on it. Finally, Zhabnov walked to the stage. He was sporting a neatly trimmed goatee and appeared at the edge of the stage in full dress uniform, his chest covered with gold and silver medals. He strode jauntily to the podium and stared down at the assembled dignitaries with a beneficent smile. Zhabnov smiled beatifically from under the enormous red banner containing his likeness, hand-stitched with silk thread.
Friends, comrades, I thank you all for coming. You are all good friends to come all this way to my little soiree here in the frontier capital of Washington. Friends, how good it is to see you all, each and every one at this momentous occasion. But before I begin, let us bow our heads and give thanks for the continued leadership of our great leader, our benefactor, the premier of all the Soviets. May he live for centuries. Premier Vasily! Now.
The people leaned forward in their seats. Here it comes. This speech would change everything.
There is the question of food production in America and how it has matched up with the last 5-year plan. I am pleased to tell you all that we have not only achieved our goals, but surpassed them with nearly 2 million bushels of surplus wheat, which has been stockpiled in emergency warehouses outside Moscow. Furthermore,
he droned on and on, citing statistic after vital statistic, as the delegates withdrew into themselves in pained boredom. So, there was to be no overt official speech condemning Kilov after all. Zhabnov was just telegraphing his feelings through symbols, such as the numbers of KGBers present and the removal of banners. He was not yet strong enough to come out and say what everyone already knew, that the war of succession between himself and Kilov had begun. Still, it showed he was perhaps cannier than many gave him credit for. There would be plays made to all who attended the wild parties to be loyal to Zhabnov's faction. The speech lasted for nearly 3 hours and 17 minutes, 16 minutes longer than the previous year's pronouncements. President Zhabnov was interrupted 72 times by applause. At last, he walked off. The ordeal was finally over. Now the delegates would revel indoors as the snow began falling more heavily. Revel and parlay votes for favors. It was at the biggest bash that Zhabnov honored the participants by appearing in casual clothes, a cardigan sweater with just one medal, and blue pants. The KGBers were long gone from Washington, walking out immediately after the long applause at the end of Zhabnov's speech and boarding one of their own heavily guarded skylifters and heading west to Denver to report back to Colonel Kilov himself. All would be reported back to Kilov. Secretly, even these icy officers longed for the revelry they would miss. Everyone knew of the drugs, the women, the entertainment that would be proffered upon the delegates, the real reason, after all, that so many attended. The delegates always left the 3-day festivities in America more committed to Zhabnov than before. And this could well be the last convention before the death of the grandfather. The delegates prayed that he would hang in there for a few more days at least so they could have their fun. Zhabnov walked around the ballroom shaking hands. Already many of the Red representatives were ensconced in side rooms and upstairs chambers, taking advantage of the seemingly endless supply of young and willing women whom Zhabnov had provided. The rest of the delegates indulged in opium-filled rooms in the sub-basement, watching erotic dancers gyrate before them, or pass the time gambling in a fully equipped game room that Zhabnov had provided. The wiliest of them, however, had remained on the main ballroom floor to greet and shake hands with Zhabnov personally, or share a toast. Zhabnov mingled with his guests, walking around the large ballroom, shaking hands, laughing louder than anyone else. He came to the portly Sikorsky, second in command of the Armenian Republic, and took him aside.
Ah, Vlad! How goes it in Armenia? Are the gypsies still stirring up trouble?
Oh, very well, Mr. President. The gypsies are being put into new pacification centers. It's going very well. Food is, of course, well, scarce. As you know, our region took some heavy losses in the last harvest storm.
I understand that you are sympathetic to our cause, and not so friendly to you-know-who.
Yes, Mr. President. But how did you know?
I have my ways. By the way, I'll speak to some of your production staff about getting some grain out your way. There's been a surplus for 2 years now. I don't think Moscow would mind a little channeling, do you?
Ah, yes, that would be wonderful. And of course, you can count on me voting the right way in the... post-Vasily area, which will soon be upon us.
Good, Vlad, good. In fact, excellent.